Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Cinema D'Amore. I am Chuck Phillips, joined by
Justin Morgan.
And we're staying in France, you know, all month long. It's where we're staying. We ain't going anywhere else. And we jumped ahead a little bit, going in chronological order. Went from the 50s, now we're in the hot 60s. Everything's a lot more exciting, unless you're the main character of our film, in which case everything's not exciting at all, and it's just a downer a lot of the time. But we're talking about The Fire Within by Louis Malle. And it's a bit of a downer. It's a little bit of a... This movie, I would say, made me think of the Bergman films I watched. It very much is in that vein of one single character study. And that character is just not having a good time in life.
Right. This is one of his... This is like the film that he was most proud of, or at least the first one he was like fully satisfied with, right? I never watched this movie before.
Yeah.
I've seen a handful of his movies from all over, not in any kind of real order. Just whatever I could get my hands on. I technically don't have my hands on The Fire Within. It was on the Criterion Channel, so if you're looking for a streaming service that has it, that's it.
Yeah, I think this. Yeah, I think.
Might be on HBO Max too.
I think this one's out of print. I bought this one, Two Lovers and Elevator to the Gallows, I think a long time ago when they were going out of print. A bunch of his other ones are still on there, like Zazie Dans Le Métro and Black Moon.
I feel like
Moon
this is still available for sale on their site.
Maybe it's just a DVD. Maybe they just never upgraded it. I know mine are DVDs, so maybe that's what I'm thinking, because I've never seen it on Blu-ray.
Yeah, an Elevator to the Gallows. Like I have a Blu-ray copy of that, so it might have went out of print and then came back in.
Yeah. I know they kind of go in and out sometimes, depending on what the rights issues.
And then
are
I've watched his very much his later like New York City ones.
Yeah,
My Dinner with Andre. And
yeah, he's an interesting director. He started out in that same period as like the French New Wave guys, but he never stuck to that kind of like one like kind of unifying concept. Like I guess a lot of people
the auteur style.
Yeah. Basically, he didn't have that. He was kind of your more standard director. You know, kind of just whatever interested him at the time he went with. I like all the movies of his that I've watched so far. I've watched more of his early films. I haven't watched any of his later American films, but I enjoyed Elevator to the Gallows, Two Lovers, this, and then I finally got around to watching Zazie Dans Le Métro for the first time, and I thought that movie was amazing.
Yeah, I still haven't watched that one.
I think you'd like that one a lot. That one's it's so fast-paced and entertaining, and I feel like I know I mentioned like how this is very much this film
slow
very much inspired
and depressing.
Like, yeah, but this inspired Wes Anderson's films, specifically Royal Tenenbaums in particular. But I feel like that Zazie is like very much, I feel like, how Wes Anderson plays children in his films. Like the kid doesn't talk like a kid, like she talks with the adults as if she's on the same level as them. She's very much makes me think of the kids in like Moonrise Kingdom, where she just converses with adults like she's on their same level, and they all kind of, no one really like ever says like, hey, you're a kid. They just kind of look at her and are like, whatever, like I don't want to get into these conversations, but I'll accept that you're swearing at me and talking about things you shouldn't be talking about.
Well, I know he worked with Brezin. Yeah. As like an AD or something, and then he had done a documentary with
Cousteau.
Yeah,
which is another like kind of like weird like Wes Anderson connection, and that, you know, that's the inspiration for The Life Aquatic.
But there you go, he's obsessed with him, and now he's finally moving around to different countries.
Yeah, now we're getting The French Dispatch.
We got that, and his next one's in Spain, so he's moving from country to country.
Yeah, he's getting more European. You know, he did his Japanese film with Isle of Dogs.
Right.
So, you know, we're getting some interesting stuff going on there, but
what was the first one? Grand Budapest Hotel. I guess yeah. Darjeeling Limited.
Darjeeling went to India. Yeah, that was inspired by Indian film. So yeah, he has gone out of his way. His first few films are all very American centric, and even with like Life Aquatic, that goes out into the wild, gets out of America. So
just
he's
straight up in the ocean.
Just he's in uncharted international waters on that one.
Where are they at that island in Life Aquatic? Isn't it an island? Were they on land at the end of that movie?
Oh, it's somewhere in Asia. Like, I think like South Asia. Like, I don't know if it was specifically like one that I can think of, but I want to say they were like somewhere near Thailand or something. I know they were in like the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, and I know too, he said that his inspiration for this film kind of came from the, how do you say it? Keiju de Cinema, the writers that were doing the critiques. They had come up with that auteur style. They're big like Hitchcock and John Ford fans, and they believed that this style could exist, and you could do these things cheaply.
Yeah.
And everything really kind of like stood out for all these directors. And from what I was reading up until this point, he just kind of wasn't really happy with his work. He was adapting a lot of stuff. Although this is an adaptation too. Like,
yeah,
this is he adapted a book.
This is from another book. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess he took more liberties with this one and made it more of his own, changed like the time. And I guess that's pretty much, they said there was some action in the other one, so he took out all the action.
Yeah.
I don't know what was the action about it, but
yeah, this movie definitely, it's a good character study. We were with the main character for the entirety of the film. It's just his, just kind of a day in his life. I guess we could say the last day of his life. And I don't know, just a strange look at, you know, I guess just that time period. I know this movie gets mocked for being, not mocked necessarily, but they kind of say this is like the stereotypical movie of like the depressed European that like everyone has of, if anyone puts like a movie on that's supposed to be like a fake European film from the 60s, they all kind of look like this, like it's just people smoking cigarettes and going like, ooh, life is depressing. I want to kill myself.
Well, that is a lot of
like,
French
like
movies.
That's the stereotypical like view that.
Well, the big difference is he's planning on doing it. It's not, you know, like that's the most of them are just depressed and they'll say things like, I don't want to live anymore, but they never kill themselves or map out that they're going to do that to themselves. Yeah. And I like too that he apparently started filming this in color and after 2 days said, I got to change it. I have to do it in black and white, which I don't know if it's sort of like more depressing to have things in black and white. I guess so. It takes all that, the color out of it. And don't you, when you associate color more so with happiness.
Yeah. I had that same thought. I did read that as well, that he changed his mind. It's all, I don't know. I was almost like surprised when they said he was going to film it in color. Cause I don't know. I just can't picture it in anything but black and white. But maybe that's just because that's how I've watched it.
It's wonderful that he has a choice. Because nowadays anybody that wants to do a black and white movie, they're like, no.
Yeah.
No, we're not gonna let you do that. I remember Frank Darabont, when he wanted to do The Mist in black and white, they would not allow him to do it. So he essentially made a black and white version from the colored version and sort of like oversaw the color correction, and it does look nice.
Yeah.
But that's the closest that he could get. He wasn't allowed to shoot it in black and white. And
yeah, there's that
DVD release of it.
Yeah, there's that aversion to doing things. Only every once in a while you get something like Nebraska that I thought's great. That's a great like pretty recent black and white film. One of the more recent ones I can think of a major director actually doing a film completely.
Louis
in black
C.K.
and white.
Made his black and white, but it never saw the light of day after he.
Yeah. His wasn't allowed to come out.
He was ousted for being a pervert.
I still think of that's what Orson Welles always said. I know Peter Bogdanovich, when he interviewed him, you know, later in his life when they were good friends, and that was his thing, was he said he's never seen a great performance in color, not once. He said all the greatest performances that have ever been on film were in black and white.
That's really funny. Like, that has anything to do with that? Like, that has nothing to do with a performance at all.
I know.
I just like black and white better. I like the contrast.
I don't think it's not that he's saying that it has anything to do with their performance, but his view was that it captures the performance better because it's the same reason I think I like black and white in a lot of things, because it's almost like there's less to distract your eye. Like, you can watch a color film and, you know, there could be something like red sitting on the back shelf and you'll be like, what is that bright red thing sitting behind that guy's arm there? Like, that's sticking out like a sore thumb, or there can be other things, but it's like, when it's in black and white, there's no hiding things behind, like, oh, like we're a big bright Technicolor, you know, dream vision. It's like, no, that you just have to focus on their performance. So,
well, like color, when it's used for a certain reason, for example, like The Sixth Sense, the color red is anything that's death is touched. Or you take a television show like Breaking Bad, and there was a color that represented every character.
Yeah.
And how prominent was also like how powerful they were in the scene or over the course of time.
There's a lot of, and I feel like hopefully we'll get to these movies. I'm surprised we haven't yet, but one of my favorite films that messes with color and black and white was Sympathy for Lady Vengeance, that Park Chan-wook did, that he did his fade to black version that is like one of the most subtle.
I think you're wrong. Draws. It's the third one.
Yeah, Sympathy for Lady Vengeance. That's the third one.
Oh, Lady Vengeance. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I think you're confusing titles. Isn't it just Lady Vengeance?
Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance is the first one. I think on some of the posters I've seen it as that, but I do think it is like usually shortened to Lady Vengeance. I know the first two have like,
that's kind of cool,
similar titles, and then the middle one's Old Boy, but
they did it like digitally too. They were just like timed it to slowly fade.
And it's like, it's cool. That works very, very well, because it's one of the most very subtle things that I've ever seen, of just it over the course of a two plus hour film, that just slowly the color just drains. It's not like all of a sudden, like it's not a harsh cut that once the color's completely gone and you're just in black and white, it's just like you almost don't even notice until you are fully into black and white that you're like, oh god, all the color's out of this film.
Or like, there's a lot of times where I just watched some of Wong Kar-wai's movies, and one of them was using black and white to represent like a different part of time.
Yeah.
Like, black and white, I think, was when the relationship was over, and color was like when it was still happening. Hmm. So I like visual cues like that. Maybe I'm pretty simplistic, but for black and white and like this, especially these French films, where I love this one, it does part of what I like, which is I love smoke in black and white for some reason.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's a cultural thing, so everybody is constantly smoking. There's not really a lot of scenes where it feels like a noir, where it's overly foggy for no reason. Yeah. And another one I like is water in black and white. And we don't really get too much in this, but you get like some droplets and stuff on a window. I don't know why. It's so simplistic, and I'm like, I really prefer it. Yeah. I'm a slightly colorblind, so I feel like that is maybe partially the reason why.
That some things just it might as well be in black and white sometimes, for all the difference you can tell between certain colors.
I'm not that bad, but yeah. Or I think of things that like Suspiria that has all these bright colors in it.
Yeah.
Or what is it? Umbrellas of Chabrol. I'm probably not saying it right, if I were to guess. That's a very colorful movie, and that's another one I was considering doing for this podcast. It's the musical that inspired La La Land. It's better than La La Land. I don't know if the singing is all that great. It's in French, so I can't really tell, but...
Is the singing all that great in La La Land?
No. Yeah, but I do like... There you go. But I do appreciate how La La Land kind of has that, like, negative, realistic ending. I know a lot of people were bitching about it. That's probably why. Yeah. I was like, I like it. I like the... I don't know why you're putting realism into a musical, but all right.
Yeah.
But I mean, I was fine with it.
Yeah.
This is really different. I'm really impressed with how 1963 they filmed this, and he's talking about anxiety, he's talking about depression, and it feels like something that is more open today, at least in America.
Yeah.
And everybody is talking about more openly. I mean, I'm on antidepressants, and it's weird because even maybe 10, 15 years ago, there's still like pretty strong stigma to it. And I still know people that when they try to sum up depression, I'm applying my own personal experience to it, but they really doesn't seem to match what I know from it. Mm-hmm. And watching this really kind of hit closer to home. Not that I'm like, I'm going to off myself in 24 hours, but all that idea too of kind of not really like trying to appreciate life, but not feeling that appreciation. Like it's not there with what you want. And his like, I feel like there's kind of a, he's not just going out to meet all these people that he, you know, friends from the past just to say goodbye. I feel like he's also trying to like find a reason not to kill himself.
I was going to ask you that if you thought that was the reason, like, was he just wanting to say goodbye, or was he hoping that there would be something that would make him want to change? And I agree with you on like the, I feel like this movie does a very good job, like you're saying, for a movie this old, being 60 years old almost, that it kind of really puts a face on, you know, what everyone, you'll hear people say, oh, well, he didn't seem sad or something like that. I could see people saying like, oh, well, yeah, he killed himself, but he didn't seem sad. And it's like, that's not always like what depression is. It's just like an empty feeling. It's not like you're not crying all the time. He seems like he talks to people and he's not like moping around really. He just kind of talks to them and
he's a little gaunt according to people.
Well, that's also partly, I think, just his, you know, that's not necessarily a sad look. It literally is. I think he's just not healthy because as he talks numerous times, he's like ruined his body with, you know, too much alcohol and everything that, else that he kept doing.
And that's another thing that was his like
coping mechanism.
It bothers me, but it also hits kind of close to home where people always try to find excuses or what the simplest thing that they can sum things up to. And I feel like a lot of people, at least a lot of the people that we saw towards the end of the film, they're going to be like, oh, it was the alcohol that did it. The alcohol did them in. And they don't really grasp what he is going through.
Yeah.
Because things aren't necessarily bad for him. I think that's the biggest misconception with depression. You could be a rich, successful person that has everything going for them, and you just have that, you know, chemical imbalance in you.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of like what he has going for him. Although I think it's odd too, and maybe it's like a product of the time. I don't know how much research went into it, but even his doctor didn't seem like that good of a, like, he didn't seem like a very good doctor at all in the beginning of the film when he came in and he's like, I think you're cured. I think you need to leave. And he is ultra depressing, and the guy's still kind of like blowing it off, like, just get out of here.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that, it might just been a thing of the time that I think they largely did. They probably did just view it as he's cured in the sense that he's not an alcoholic anymore, and I think that's all they view it as, like, oh, you're cured, you're not an alcoholic anymore. Like, it's kind of the same way, like you're saying. Like, they use that as an excuse, like, well, as long as he doesn't drink anymore, then he'll be fine. He won't hurt himself. As long as he's off of alcohol, he'll be fine. Nothing will go wrong in his life. And I think that's how his doctor views it. And that's how kind of like the other people around him that say, oh, you've been cured. Like the Lydia, the woman that he's with at the beginning of the film, who's a friend of his wife's back in New York. that she sent over.
That is a weird relationship that I wanted to bring up, too. I don't know if it's, it's a French thing or what, but apparently she's considered, a go-between. So, since his wife is in New York and he's in France, that's her friend, and it's okay that he sleeps with her since he's not in New York currently. It's not like an affair.
Yeah, but he even brings up that she's his wife's probably already with another person anyway. Like she more or less only sends him money to pay the doctor's bills because she feels bad for him. Not that she really loves him, even though that's what the doctors and everyone at the clinic that he's at keeps going. Just wait for that letter from your wife. And he's like, my wife's not going to write me. Like, you don't understand. My wife's not going to write me anymore. She doesn't want to talk to me.
That's saying American women, they're strong. I'm like, what kind of doctor are you besides a terrible doctor?
Never any stereotypes. Doesn't make any goddamn sense. Some weird French stereotype. Oh, those Americans, they can handle things.
Well, I was reading too that he apparently in real life, Mal, he had some sort of similar relationship too, where he had a mutual friend that he would sleep with when he was away in a different country away from his wife or something.
Yeah. I mean, that's a real life thing.
I feel like it's more of a French thing. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Not even French, a European thing in general. I mean, there's always been that, that's always the view of Americans, the uptight Americans that oh, you have to get married and be with someone forever. That's very much an Italian thing too. There's a lot of Italian films do the same thing, right? Where it's just
It only threw me off because the beginning of the movie, when I don't know what is happening and he's having a relationship with this woman, then he's talking about his wife and I'm thinking, oh, it's an affair, which is, the biggest French thing I think I see in most of French New Wave. And then it sounds like a mutual thing that his wife is okay with. And I'm like, all right, well, this is taking many turns within the first couple minutes of the movie. I also like the chess set too, which I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I really appreciated when at the end of the movie, the next day, they show the chess set and all the pieces are just totally out of order, just laying all over. It's just something real simple, but
yeah, we see his apartment in the clinic that he's at, and he is a very morbid person right off the bat. We see he clips news articles about kids killing themselves and women dying in accidents. As anytime it seems like there's anytime there's a news report about someone dying, he clips it out and puts it on his wall. Which again, I did think the same thing of. That when the doctor's you're cured, and I'm like, have you seen his decor? He's got clippings on the wall of people that killed themselves. I don't think he's cured.
I also thought it was interesting too. They talked about America because his wife's and Dorothy is in New York, and the one guy said something like "Land of JFK." I looked up the film. The film came out in October, easily 50 days or something before JFK was assassinated.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's so weird because it's so morbid. It doesn't necessarily match the context, but it has a completely strange meaning because in that exact moment when they're filming that movie and they're talking about him, he's alive. He's the president of the United States. Yeah. And it's slightly eerie. I don't know. I think maybe that's most of the movie. I don't have an uncomfortable feeling watching this movie. I just think I always find things like that are oddly timed, coincidences, I guess. I don't know what else to call it.
Yeah, it's a good, I guess I almost want to describe it as he has his Odyssey in Paris. It's one night of, it does really feel to me he is searching for someone to give him a reason not to kill himself. He kind of starts out with maybe his wife was kind of his first hope, but then again, he's pretty much resigned that she's not going to answer his letters back. Then it's Lydia, this other woman. And he tells her, hey, don't go back to New York, stay. And she says, no, pretty much when she says, no, I have to leave And that's basically when he says, okay, well then that's it. Like basically you've sealed it. If you won't stay with me, then I made my mind up. Like, I'm going to do it. If you're just going to leave me like everybody else does. And he kind of like slams the door on the hospital when he goes back in on her, and that's the last time we see the characters together at all. More or less like, oh, okay, well, if you're not going to stay with me and help me when I'm asking you to help me, you know, your work's more important than I am, then I guess I'm just done. And then we get to, you know, he's out in Versailles, and everyone keeps kind of telling him, like almost kind of like, again, they say he's cured, but then they say, but just don't go back to somewhere like New York City or Paris. Like, you'll get sucked back into that world, and you'll want to start doing the things you used to do. And
it's a strange ideology I don't quite get, because even when he goes back, well, before he gets there in Versailles, he goes into a bar. Well, it's not a bar; it's like a pharmacy that apparently.
I feel like it's just
wine.
Yeah,
in the
I feel
afternoon.
Like that's a very specifically like French or European thing of you can get alcohol just anywhere. Like, it doesn't.
I
have
love
to
them
be a
asking
bar.
For his cigarettes, and they're like, "We don't carry any Irish cigarettes. You should start doing it." It's like, buddy, you're the only person that would get it, and they would go. They would expire.
Yeah.
But yeah. I do like those guys showing up. They're like drivers of some sort, like delivery drivers or truck drivers in Europe. And they stop for wine. And it's funny because he asks if he can hitch a ride to Paris. And they said it's against company policy. But apparently drinking in the middle of the day is not against company policy.
I mean, hey, you watched Mad Men. That's not even a French thing. That was just an acceptable, like, hey, we're going to lunch. We're gonna have like six.
Well, that's
old
different.
Fashions,
these are people are like driving
back.
The trucks.
Yeah, but who cares?
Mad Men, at least they were Mad Men. They walked down to the bar and they walked back to where they worked.
Yeah.
They didn't, they were catching cabs and shit. This is like, these are the, they'd be like the Amazon delivery man's like, I'm just going to stop for a couple beers and then I'm going to go out and finish delivering these packages.
Yeah. Who knows? You know, it's not I mean, I'm sure there's still somebody doing, I'm sure there, you say that like there's not people that are still doing that today. Like,
I think you're big
guarantee.
Probably alcoholic then. I one time when I was working, it was at the end of the day, and they were celebrating the wrap of our movie, so they were starting to do margaritas, and they gave me one, and I'm like, I'm just going to finish this little bit of work that I have left, and I think within 10 minutes of drinking, I wasn't drunk, but I had no concentration on my work at all. I was like, I can't do this. I'm done with it. So I guess in a way commend the people of Madison Avenue in the 1960s because I couldn't drink and work.
Tougher than you. They were chain smoking packs of cigarettes a day and drinking six old fashions or gin and tonics by lunchtime, and
they were taking
their
LSD and all their kind of fun stuff. So yeah. They are definitely stronger than me. But maybe if you build up to it like an alcoholic, then you would be fine.
Yeah, everyone constantly he keeps getting offered alcohol very, very early on, you know, when he goes to the old hotel that he used to stay at, and the barman starts trying to give him a drink, and you know, everyone keeps trying to get it like it's one of those things. They just know, they haven't seen him in so long, but they just go, oh, Alan loves alcohol, let's get him a drink. Like, they're all prepared to just give him alcohol as soon as
they
see him.
Well, they also don't see it as a problem. They saw it as he was just like really fun guy or something.
Yeah, everyone has fun stories about him. Like, no one ever has like a oh yeah, he was a bad guy. It's always, oh yeah, Alan was the life of the party. He had all the women wanted to be with him, and everyone wanted to be his friend. And he
does get called out for being alcoholic a lot, though.
Well, yeah, I mean they you know, they don't completely he's not completely like labeled as, oh yeah, you were the greatest guy in the world. But and he mentions, you know, why he does it. He doesn't say that he did it, you know, because he liked it or anything. He does say a few times in the movie, you know, when people ask him, oh, you know, you used to do that. And he says, like, you know, yeah, he was more or less trying to like fill a void, or the way he puts it is that kind of like, which does sound like maybe like a weird like chemical imbalance, that he said his life always feels like it's moving in slow motion, and the only way to get it to go in regular speed was to drink, and that would like it would make his brain feel like he was finally moving at a normal pace and that things were happening, but just that then it would get out of control when he kept doing it for too long. And
it's
like
crazy
that
what they're describing. It's crazy what they're describing, because clearly this is something that's happened to human beings for all time, and now there's medications and people understand it a lot better.
Yeah.
But in the 60s, it's like they could clearly describe what they were going through, but had no help whatsoever.
Yeah.
I mean, even when they reach out to people, people are like, I don't know what you want me to do. If you're not happy, you're not happy. I can't do anything.
Yeah.
Which is also true. I do like, though, that when he goes around and he's trying to, like, he meets up with these people, but they're not even, like, he's never satisfied with it. And I wouldn't be satisfied with it either. I like his friend, that the one that he meets around lunch, that's become a family man. And it's sort of like, what is this? What have you become? This isn't who you are.
Yeah. He says that's the one that he, you know, kind of brings up, like, that he can't live his life in mediocrity. And, you know, his friend's kind of like offended, like, oh, well, I mean, you call it mediocrity, but, you know, I enjoy coming home, having a couple glasses of wine, writing about Egypt. You know,
he loves Egypt. Yeah, he loves Egypt. I love that. That's my favorite thing about that guy.
His character trait is that he just loves Egypt.
His goal in life is to make a book that people can learn about Egyptian culture from.
He just loves Egypt. It's such a specific character trait for that guy that really bears nothing on the rest of the plot, that he just loves Egypt. But yeah, I enjoy that. And that's another thing that I feel is like very realistic, in that, you know, I think everyone might go through that at some point. Some people would say, like, you know, more or less like, oh, you're settling, like, you know, could he have done something? That our main character kind of views it as, you know, oh, you could have been doing something way more interesting. You could be out there, you know, really doing adventuring or something like that. And he's like, instead you just sit here and you write about Egypt, you write about a dead society that's not advancing or anything. Like, you could be doing something way better. And his friend kind of just tells him, like, yeah, but I enjoy it. Like you might not think it's interesting. It might not satisfy you, but I love it. Like, it's kind of, you know, it's everyone has their own thing that they enjoy. Just because Alan isn't interested in settling down and just studying old things.
Our expectations are, they seem to be that, like, we're going to be destined for great things. And I don't know why that is what you tell most children. But, you know, I went to film school, and I'm like, oh, I would love to eventually someday write and direct. And it's obviously it's hard. I know it's an uphill battle, and it's not something that is going to be handed to you unless you're Wes Anderson or some rich kid. Yes, it is a little bit handed to you.
Unless you're Johnny Paramount.
Yeah, Johnny Paramount. I remember working at the bank and being so depressed, like, is this it? This is really it. And there's some creepy thing that they said when I was at, they had like a 7-day training session, and it was like, all roads lead to banking. Like, no matter what you do, you're going to end up in the banking world. And I thought, that is terrifying. And the fact that the banks aren't even like your small town bank, where it's just like people being friendly, you have to push all these sales on people, get people to invest in things. And where I was at, everybody was old. They can't invest in anything. They're going to be dead before their investment pays out. Stuff like that. But when I'm just like working there, I said, and I'm still kind of that person where I'm sitting behind a desk most of my days, I said, I do not want to be the person that works in an office behind a desk. And I become the person that is doing exactly that. And it's sort of weird, because it's like, I mean, I don't expect to have some crazy sort of importance. Like, I don't plan to be anybody significant. But I kind of despise that American, like work your ass off for nothing. They just like that kind of like it, I think, and I've thought about this too, is like a horror film idea. Stuck in a dead end job is like a scarier thought to me than most things.
Yeah.
This film doesn't really touch on any of that, but it's kind of like that's me relating like the mundaneness of these things. And he's looking for people, and I do like how a lot of the people, like, he's not satisfied with the guy that's the, you know, that he meets for lunch, which is pretty much me, except for the Egyptian culture. I don't do that. But I'm kind of in the similar mindset where I'm married, and I like coming home and kind of winding down, and I'm fine with that, and going out every once in a while. That's more so my style. But like when we get to the end of the film and he meets those aristocrats, like the high class people, like that's another side of society that I don't understand. The people that aren't really happy and misrepresent themselves as people that are like have it all and are doing everything that they want. It doesn't necessarily have to be rich people, but people that think, you know, I'm going to show off all my things and I'm going to pretend to be happy. And I kind of like, unfortunately, I agree with the protagonist of this movie where it's like, there's no purpose to what you're doing. It is completely meaningless. You're living an unhappy life and you know that you're living an unhappy life and you're just doing this to make, like, I don't know, the illusion that people think you're happy. And for me, I'd rather actually be happy than try to put on some sort of show for people.
Yeah.
Do you want to be happy, Chuck?
Nah, I'm pretty fine being miserable. No. You're making me think of it kind of connects both ways to, you know, no one wants to settle for like a mediocre dead end job. But then you also have, you know, the rich upper class that kind of tells you that like, oh, you should be happy that you have like a meaningless dead end job, you know, that, you know, you get food. That's like, I know there was a quote from Elon Musk about, however it was, like no one, you know, builds rockets and goes to space only working like a 40 hour work week or something like that. Like basically it was like, if you want to get ahead anywhere, you need to, you know, work 80 hours a week and sacrifice everything else in your life to do that. Well,
the biggest difference is you have to be the entrepreneur to do that. Otherwise you're like, I saw something I think Justin Portman posted that was like a boss that was like, oh, I like your new Lamborghini. And he's like, well, if you keep working hard every week and really put in that extra time, I'll have a new Lamborghini next year too.
Yeah.
It's like, that's exactly what it is. You're like not working for yourself. There's no improvement on yourself.
Yeah.
It's kind of it's like essentially a pyramid scheme of some sort.
Yeah. I've seen the pictures that like, I think somebody had it, because I work at Lowe's, and it might have been at Home Depot. It might not have been a Lowe's one specifically.
Wait, you were at Home Depot?
No, it's a meme on Reddit. It's not a meme. It is an actual picture that somebody had at like in their break room or something. That it had the pyramid, but it was like flipped upside down, and the largest section was customers. Then it was like frontline retail employees. Then it got smaller, like management, and then it got smaller to like CEOs and owners. And I was like, yeah, see how it's flipped upside down? Because it's a funnel that funnels everything down to like the one or two people at the very top. Like everything from everyone else runs down to like the two people that run the company, and they make the millions.
I mean, to a degree, I don't have a problem with somebody that's like started up a company, and hopefully they are giving health benefits and paying these people well and not taking advantage of them. But that idea of like, I'm really going to get ahead in life if I work 60 hours this week.
Yeah.
That was my week last week. I worked 60 hours. I actually did sneak away for the Green Day concert. But I was tired as hell. Bum. I know, I did sneak out of there.
That's how
but
I
they I They're like, yeah, work full 60-hour weeks, and we'll be allowed to work a sixth day. Yeah. And the thing that's
your reward for working is more work.
You're going to get paid more, but you're going to put in more work.
Yeah.
But the worst thing about it is if you literally dropped dead, you're replaced. There's nothing that... I mean, there's another person out there that can do what you do.
Yeah. That's what I still see that at work. And I don't know. I feel like it might have... A long time ago, it might have worked out a little bit more that way. There is that idea that... You know, I don't know, back in like the 1920s that man, that guy's a real hard worker. We should move him up to management. But that's just not how it works anymore. It's more or less like, are you like friends with the people that are already in power? Like, do they want to promote you and make you also a manager? Because I've worked with people that are like, I can't understand why I didn't get promoted. I'm like, what made you think you were going to get promoted? They're like, I get all the credit card apps that they asked me to. And I worked like an extra day last week when they asked me to, and they told me to do this. And I was like, yeah, but you still haven't given me a reason for why you thought you were going to get promoted. And they're like, but I did all that extra stuff. And I'm like, yeah, but like that manager over there doesn't like you. So why is he going to promote you? Like, he doesn't care that you got some credit card apps and got a good survey. Like, that's not what's.
Or I worked with a guy that he ended up moving up in the bank to this like more corporate position, like not in the customer service type section. And he's a father of three. He's from Ghana. He has a thicker accent. And a lot of the stuff he was doing over the phone. And I guess a lot of people like complained about not being able to understand him and stuff. So they found the reason to get rid of him, to fire him. And it's like, he worked his ass off to get to that position. And then, you know, you basically fired him on a trait that you should have known about the minute that you had interviewed him for that type of work. And he's the nicest guy, you know? So you can work your ass off and you're not important anyways.
Yeah.
Anyways, this was a great movie, Chuck. Yeah. It's
really bringing you up. You know, last week we had the constant thought of death and explosions. This week we have the constant anxiety of life. You know, next week is going to be where we really get into that happy
film. It doesn't get any better.
I kind of sat there and thought about it. And I was like, the last film you chose, I was like, oh, that's where we get to like actually like have like a kind of fun movie to talk about. Oh, that's
and
where
I almost
we actually,
didn't go that route. Yeah, I almost didn't do that.
You almost went full depressing for the entire month. You could have gone there, but you were like, you know what? We'll lighten it up a little bit with that last one. We'll give it a little bit of a break.
I was thinking it's almost all black and white. It's almost all depressing. Yeah. It's definitely all French, but it's funny that if we picked the theme of like depression and we picked like all the same movies.
Yeah, basically.
And, like, all these movies are French. You're like, what do you want from me?
What do you expect? Yeah, he's I enjoy too some of the people that see him, like kind of when they first see him. Oh, you look great. We haven't seen you. And then kind of like he'll walk away, and then he'll overhear him like in the hotel where they're like, did you see how bad he looked? Like, did you see how pale he looks? Like they kind of like everyone pretends that he still looks the same sometimes. And then like we get that group of guys at the cafe after he takes his first sip of alcohol, and he goes up into the restroom, and then he comes back down, and the one guy looks at him and from a distance and just goes, that's what alcohol will do to you. There's like, he used to be like a real handsome, like nice guy, and everyone loved him. And now
they're a little two-faced. There's a couple moments, especially like when he goes to that hotel bar in the morning, and the people are like, oh, I haven't seen you so long. You look so great. And when he walks in the bar, they're like, that alcoholic, he looks terrible.
Yeah.
And I like that the choice was he's far enough. Like, it's, we can hear it because the camera doesn't follow him. The door kind of like shuts and we see him like in there, and we're still out there. So we're able to hear the gossip that he doesn't hear. But I think he feels it. He knows it's being said. Yeah, it wouldn't be a surprise if he had heard it. They said that he lost 40 pounds for this too. And I have a hard time seeing that, because wasn't Elevator to the Gallows, that's him.
Mm-hmm.
That's before this.
Yeah.
How long before this?
That was 1958, I think.
Like, did he put on a ton of weight and then lose 40 pounds? I mean,
yeah.
He doesn't look great in this, but he doesn't look like he lost 40.
I mean, hey,
he's Robert De Niro or something.
Christian Bale. Yeah.
I wanted to say, too, just because you brought up Christian Bale, a little side note. I had bought the 4K version of American Psycho,
yeah.
And now there's like a nice steelbook coming out, and it's only like $2 more than what I paid for it. And I was like,
Every time.
But I think they're just trying to sell discs they can't get rid of. They're like, recycle it.
Yeah.
We'll put the disc in a metal case.
And... yeah. Just try to get a sucker to pay for it again.
But yeah, which would probably be me if I didn't just buy it.
It happens. But yeah, he just can't find anyone out there that can give him a reason. He meets a couple people for some like shorter conversations. He meets one of his art friends and kind of sees their group where they all just kind of they're like a lot more like philosophical about I don't have to do drugs, I don't have to drink alcohol, I do it because it makes me better at my art, or you know, I do it because I like the way it feels. And he kind of like sees through them all and is like, you know, you guys are the same as everyone else, you're just drinking because you have an emptiness in you just the same as me, but you just don't want to admit it. And then he meets his friends that it sounds like he mentions that he used to be in the military, or his doctor I think mentions it earlier that he was in the military, and it sounds like he has some friends that like they sound like they're mercenaries in Algeria. It doesn't sound like they're an actual like military unit, but they just like go there as mercenaries to try to you know, fight alongside and get paid
infamous plot. You come back from the war, you become a hitman.
Yeah. So they do all sorts of illegal things. He's looking for two brothers that are in prison at the moment because they were getting involved in some illegal activities. And
I do like that guy that he meets out from prison, and he's like, "You look terrible," and that guy laughs. And it's probably the only bit of comedy in the entire thing, in the entire movie. But I like the guy that steals the straws, and he looked like they make eye contact, like he got caught stealing straws. So,
yeah, that's a good moment. There's a that's something that he does a little bit there in the middle of the film. We kind of see him do a lot of people watching, and again, it kind of like seems like he's like looking for someone to you know, connect with. There's that girl at like the table next to him that keeps looking over at him like she wants to talk to him, but he kind of just like keeps looking away before he takes a drink of alcohol.
She's interested in him, and that other guy's like, I think it's funny because it's not just comedy, but it also applies to the mundaneness that guy is saying. There's no point worth living, and you have a guy that's literally stealing plastic straws.
Yeah, I like his friends from his military, or you know, mercenary friends from Algeria. That's kind of like they're almost the only people in the film that are 100% honest with him. Like, yeah, like how you're saying that guy that looks at him was like, "You look like crap." Like everyone else tries to be like, "No, you know, you could stay with us if you want. We could have lunch. Like I'll help you out, man." Like these are the only people in the entire movie that straight up are just like, "Yeah, you look terrible. Like you might as well just be a, you know, come with us. And you know, if you die, you die, whatever. We don't really care. We just want to get paid money. Like, you know, why don't you just join up with us?" Which he seems to, you know, he doesn't agree with their idea either. Everyone always has that he keeps encountering has a different idea for what would make them happy. And, you know, their whole goal is, you know, I don't know, get paid like $200 today to go kill somebody or do something, or, you know, maybe rob a bank or something like that. And just the thrill of it. And he's like, I don't think that's for me. That's not going to, you know, make me any happier or make me want to keep living.
I like when he has that. I feel it's like it's a 10-minute scene. Maybe it's not that long, where he's at his place and it's just like ultra boring, and like he's playing with like figurine, like he pops the head off that one figurine.
Yeah. Checks the chessboard.
Yeah, he takes the American flag, and it's just sort of like nothing even in his place satisfies him. It also is, I mean, this is a product of the times. I know we're talking about France, but like the weird stuff that like he kept his like keys in or whatever, his wallet in, reminded me of like stuff that would literally be at my grandparents, like this really ornate porcelain piece of art to just drop your shit for, in.
As a key holder, yeah.
Like, that's the exact stuff that, like, a grandparent, my grandparent would have. And it's funny because it seems to me, like, I don't know, tacky, but at the time, like, it's status and I don't know. Yeah. Like, who saw that thing? It's like, yeah, I definitely need this.
I like your description of status. It's like someone comes in your house and they're like, God, I bet they paid a lot to throw their keys into that.
Yeah.
I bet they paid a lot of good money for that. What do we throw our keys on? Just a bowl?
Yeah. We just set it on the table.
What are we, animals? We just hang it on a hook?
We're a bunch of peasants.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, he, you know, he just can't seem to get anywhere. Yeah, that final party that he's at after he has the drink of alcohol and kind of like, I don't know, I guess just to say like relapses at that moment and kind of stumbles to their house. And they kind of, you know, basically just treat him like a child, like, oh, let him sleep it off. He's a big boy. He'll figure it out later.
I'm not a fan of that guy that's there, too. He's such a dickhead.
Wait, the guy that doesn't drink?
Yeah, the guy that's, like overly dramatic and, get out of here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where he meets, everyone else feels like they have, like, I don't want to say a realness to them, but like these are definitely the people, I think you brought it up earlier, that are like, that everything's kind of like a fake facade. Like they all like casually mention that Alan has had a relationship with like all of the women there at one point or another, like other than the one guy's main wife.
Yeah, Solange.
Yeah.
I like when it was like, you were really good at fucking, and she's like, yeah, I was. They don't phrase it that way. Yeah. It's just like, I love making love. And it was like, oh, you're really good at it. And it's like, the fuck conversation are they having right now? Yeah. And he just sort of had that weird, like, you know, I would totally probably try to have a relationship with you if you weren't already in one.
Yeah. Yeah. He's that's like his last, I don't know, I don't want to say like his last hope, but she's like the last person that he tries to reach out to. That's like, I don't know, maybe if you just leave your husband and come with me, I'll, you know, things will be different.
They did say his weakness was women. And, well, I think maybe he says that.
I think he does say
it. If he wasn't so attracted to these women and stuff like that, he would have, like, killed himself a long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah, he's very down on himself a lot. He says, like,
he's depressed, but when he's horny, he's less depressed.
Yeah. It's the same as, like, the alcohol. Like, those are the two things that, like, kind of made his life feel more balanced was alcohol and women. And, but then he mentions, I think it's with his friend that his family man friend, that he says something about I'm a terrible lover, and since I'm a terrible lover, I drink, and when I drink, I'm a terrible lover. Like he keeps, like, it's just a big circle of everything's terrible, and no one's satisfied to be with me. Like, but yeah, that's like that party is seemingly the final straw, I guess, where he kind of like sees that nobody's going to really help him. Everything's kind of, there's kind of a fakeness to everything. Everyone that says like, oh yeah, maybe just, you know, they tell him like, come with us to lunch tomorrow. And that's one of the few times where he does say that he's going to come back and go to lunch with them. With everybody else, he doesn't flat out say he's going to kill himself. But like with the family man, he says like, I don't think you understand, like I'm leaving for good. He kind of like phrases it to everybody like that. Like, no, you don't understand. I'm not going to be here tomorrow. I'm going to go somewhere. And I think someone's like, oh, you're going somewhere to New York. And he's like, no, I'm going, like, I'm not going to come back. And
I do like when he leaves that party at the end and they're like, we'll see you tomorrow. And he's like, yeah, sure, I'll see you tomorrow. Like, yeah. He like mirrors their fakeness.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of why I feel like those are the only people that he says that to. Everybody else, you know, the criminal types and the artist and the family man, he very much flat out tells them like, yeah, I'm just not gonna, you know, this is the end for me. Like, if I leave here today, I'm not gonna come back ever. And, yeah, he does kind of like have that same level of, you know, oh, you're gonna have lunch with us, right? Oh yeah, sure. Like, kind of like a, yeah, I can tell you don't really care about me. Like, you don't really care if I killed myself.
Now, when he finally does kill himself, which happens.
Spoiler alert.
I know. 50 so minutes into this.
Yeah.
I'm kind of interested in the way that he does it. It seems such like a weird, like he shoots himself in the heart, which I don't know. I'm just not used to seeing anything like that when somebody commits suicide with a gun in a movie. And it like cuts to him dead with his like, I think it's like his suicide telegram. What is that? What it is?
I feel like that was the last thing that he wrote before he tore up. Cause we see him write, but we never see what he does write. He writes in that journal and he mentions to someone like, yeah, I ripped it up today. I didn't even keep it. So I feel like that was supposed to be what his last thing that he wrote in there. And then he kind of like read it and then ripped it up when he saw it. And
well, maybe good, because it's quite selfish. Like, he puts blame, it sounds like, on everyone else instead of taking responsibility for himself. Like, it's like, it's kind of your fault that I'm no longer here. So maybe it's a good thing that he tore that up. I thought it was maybe what he sent his wife.
Could be it, too. I kind of forgot about that he does send he sends one telegram that his because his doctor keeps saying like maybe send a telegram. It's faster than a letter. You know, it's more direct. You can get a response quicker if you send a telegram. And he gives it to that girl at the beginning of the film. And yeah, she says something like, "Oh, telegram, is it urgent?" And he's like, "Telegrams usually are." I do love that response. Telegrams usually are urgent. So yeah, it could have been one or the other. I guess it could have either been the last thing that he wrote, or it could have specifically
at the very least it's his suicide. It's his suicide.
Yeah, it's something that he wrote. I know that I think it's at least supposed to be implied that it was him writing. It's not like it's not credited as being like a quote from somebody else or anything like that. So I believe it is supposed to be his note. But yeah, I don't know.
Who, if anyone read it, is, I guess,
yeah,
up to interpretation.
Yeah, yeah. Who it went to, or if anybody actually heard it, or if it was just tore up and was in the garbage. But yeah, his final note is, you know, yeah, basically like, yeah, what does he say? I tried to get close to you and you pulled away. You know, I tried to, hopefully in death it'll pull you closer. I can't remember I don't have the exact translation in front of me, but
he was talking about like being loose, and now he's tightened things up.
Yeah. Which, you know, I don't know. I don't know that there's any
more artsy than he seemed the entire movie.
Yeah. I don't know that there's any good way to, obviously, I guess, to write a suicide note.
Enjoy when he's in the truck with those guys and they ask him if he works and he says no, he has a disease. And when they're like, "Well, what's your disease?" And he's like, "It's with my heart." He's not lying, but I feel like they take it as it is. He literally has heart problems,
yeah.
And he's like it's like his emotional state. That's what he means.
Yeah, that's more what he's implying. Yeah, yeah, like I think they tell him he looks like he has money or something like that. Like he looks well off, and he's like, and he just goes, "I'm not." And they're just like, "Well, I'm just saying you look like you have money." But yeah, I feel like I've enjoyed all of Louis Malle's movies. Most of them are on the Criterion Collection, so you should go check those out. This one's always stuck with me more than a lot of the other ones. I don't know what that says about me, but I think it's a pretty good film, and you know, definitely worth getting into.
Right. Well, it was an excellent pick, I have to say. I'm glad that I finally got a chance to see it. Well, I guess it's always been at my fingertips. It was on the Criterion Channel, like I've already said. Love the selection. I think it's way better than every other streaming service out there right now. I highly recommend it, because when you get into things like Netflix, they start dropping older content. It's harder to find. All you're finding is their original content. And hopefully it gets a Blu-ray release or something. Next week, another Criterion, La Haine. From 1995. I love this movie. Just gets better over time. That's what we'll be discussing. If you follow us on Twitter at Cinema de More or Facebook /Cinema de More, that is where you will see our ads. And if you weren't following I guess I told you. I already spoiled it. Sometimes we don't tell you, so you'll never know. Anyways, thank you for listening.
Thanks.
We are Cinema D'Amore. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter to stay up to date with news and information on upcoming episodes. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audible, Pandora, Alexa, or iHeartRadio. It would be greatly appreciated if you subscribe to our podcast on your platform of choice. We also appreciate feedback, so rate us, review us, and let us know what you think. And above all else, thank you for listening.